You are listening to Graceway's weekly message podcast. We hope that this message encourages you to know and enjoy God, find friends, discover your purpose, and make a difference in your community. Be sure to check out the Let's Talk podcast on Tuesdays to hear additional thoughts on today's topic. Enjoy the message.
We're going to be in the book of Daniel. You want to dial that in right now, Daniel chapter 2. That's where we're going to hang out. And we're dealing with a question, those times when it seems like God has forgotten. So we're going to be talking a bit about suffering and pain and the sovereignty of God, which is a theological word that simply means God is God and always has been and always will be, and He does whatever He wants to do, okay? We all agree upon that. That's really going to be our theme this morning. And I love the fact that Pastor Tim, by the way, the reason he's not here, he is enjoying a well-deserved vacation. And so that's why I'm back here this morning and thrilled to be there. Cheryl and I have been on the road most of this year and have very rarely had the chance to be here, so we're enjoying being home for a few days before we take off again. But Pastor Tim has been leading us through this amazing story of through the Bible. The entire Bible in a year. I know that seems impossible. And those of you old-timers were here when I had that job. You know, my style at that time was, let's get lost in the weeds together. Like, let's study Ephesians for the next 3 years or something like that. But Pastor Tim has very wisely said, you know what, sometimes it's good just to get that bird's eye view, that big picture view of the Bible. And I have absolutely been fascinated and love this series. When we're not here, we're watching through streaming, and hope that you are doing the same thing. We started off in creation, and then the flood, and then the Exodus, and the Jewish monarchy, and then the northern tribes were taken into exile by the Assyrians, and now the southern tribes have been taken into exile by Babylon. And among those people being taken into exile is a young teenager from Jerusalem by the name of Daniel. And he's the guy that we're going to be talking about this morning. You know, I was thinking just the other day, my wife and I just got back on Tuesday from about 3 weeks in Santiago, Chile. And I know that's a long ways away, which is why most of you have never been there. It's much closer to go to Europe than it is to go to Santiago, Chile. And so I was thinking about this series of going through the entire Bible because Santiago, Chile is a weird country in the sense it's a beautiful country, but it's the longest country in the world. It's not very wide, but it's long. It's longer than our country is wide. And so it stretches from a desert that they share with Peru all the way down to Antarctica and the penguins, okay? And all along the interior wall of Chile with Argentina is this mountain range. And it is the second highest mountain range in the world outside of the Himalayas. And right outside of Santiago, just about an hour and a half, is a mountain called Mount Aconcagua, which is the second highest mountain on the planet after Mount Everest. It tops out at over 23,000 feet. Now, just to give you a perspective, okay, the highest mountains in Colorado top out a little over 14,000 feet. But remember, Denver is over 5,000 feet. So do the math, okay, and figure out how far those mountains are actually above the ground. So when you go into Santiago, Santiago is like 30 or 40 minutes from the ocean. And then 30 or 40 minutes the other way, the Andes start and go up. Mount Aconcagua is over 23,000 feet, which makes the Rockies in Colorado look like nice rolling hills. And the thing that is so cool about that, you look at these things. When we got there, it's winter time there now, so we got off the plane to 30 degree temperature and snow, but that's just the way that it is. Now, by the way, another little fact for you just to think about, just to get your mind juices flowing this morning. 2/3 of the Jesus followers in the world today are people of color who live in the southern hemisphere. And what that means is when we are jingle-belling and riding around in one-horse open sleighs at Christmas time, most of the Christians in the world celebrate Christmas time in the middle of summer. Okay, just kind of give you a little different perspective. The perspective thing is what I'm talking about, because those mountains are so high, and you're standing there going, oh my word, that's just incredible. And you think, how could I ever climb? How could I ever get over? How could I ever? And if you've ever tried to climb in mountains like that, it's like, oh my word, you're just taking one step at a time and so on. But I've had the opportunity on numerous occasions to fly over those mountains. And it is such an incredible thing. You're high, and you're looking down on these peaks like Mount Aconcagua, and you're going, there's Chile, and there's Argentina, and it just gives you, I mean, it's like everything in the world just comes into sync. You ever had an experience like that? That's the way going through the Bible in a year is doing for me, at least. I hope it's doing the same thing for you. It's like, okay, what is the main thing? And let's make the main thing the main thing. And as we've gone through that, have you noticed how at every point Pastor Tim brings us back to the fact that Israel's story is illustrating for us that when you try to relate to God on the basis of law and rule keeping and performance, it not only doesn't work, it is detrimental to our spiritual health. And all the way through, and all of this was designed by God to teach us that lesson. I mean, when Moses came down with those two tables of stone and the law and all these things, do you think that God was surprised that nobody could ever keep all that? Do you think that God in heaven was pulling his hair out like, oh no, they didn't keep it. What am I going to do now? Where's plan B? Now, that was the plan. To show us that that doesn't work, and that from the very beginning, before the law, during the law, after the law, Old Testament, New Testament, God has always desired to dwell with his people and in his people and to enjoy a relationship with him of reciprocal love. As Pastor John said in his first letter, we love him because he first loved us. That's the lesson that we're seeing played out over and over and over and over. And so God is always in complete control. He's sovereign. He wants that relationship with us. And now in our journey through the Bible, we've come to the days and times of Daniel. And Daniel and his three friends are in exile. That's what we're going to be talking about, exile this morning. And I want you to know something very, very important. Don't forget this. They are in exile, not because of any particular sins that they have committed, but because of the sins of their people. Now, let that sink in, okay? Are you with me? Are you there this morning? Hello, let me know. All right, thank you. Scared me there for a second. Pastor Tim's not here, man. I've lost him already. Okay, stick with me. This is so, so important. Exile, the dictionary definition, is exile is the state of being barred from one's native country, typically for political or punitive reasons, typically, but not exclusively. And that's where I want to go with this morning. Now, typically, okay, we're seeing examples of this right now, right before our eyes with what's going on in Ukraine. Hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian people have been exiled from their home country, not because they want to leave, but because they have been forced into exile for political reasons. Some of them have made their way to Kansas City, as have many Afghans for the same reason. They have been forced into exile. Before them, it was the Syrians, and on and on and on goes human history. This is not a new thing. So we see people in exile. I've been a part of this church for over 50 years, and I can tell you without doubt that there are people sitting here this morning who themselves find themselves here in this city because they have been exiled from their own home country. And it's been that way the whole time that I've been around, and it will be that way in the future. People are always in that condition of going through that time of exile. And often in those situations, we have the tendency to say, has God forgotten? Well, when can I go back? Or can I go back? Or do I want to go back? And what's going on here? So how do we handle it when we are suffering the collateral damage of the collective sins of society, and it seems like God has forgotten? Are you with me? I mean, we look around like, the world's in a mess! Yeah. Is it your fault? Well, no, not individually, but I'm sure suffering the consequences of that. So how do I handle it? So that's why today I want to talk about how to excel in exile. You ever feel like you're paying for the sins of other people? I mean, it's bad enough to pay for our own sins, and we do that, right? When we sin, we suffer the consequences of that. We have to deal with it. We have to clean it up, all that good stuff. But on top of that, it seems like so much of the time we are paying for somebody else's sin. And so those are some of the questions we want to examine this morning. I warn you, I do not have all the answers, but I do have five suggestions for us this morning on how we can excel even when we find ourselves in exile. And by the way, just a couple of thoughts to conclude this little introduction with. Pandemic. You know what it feels to be in exile. Feels like we've been exiled from normality, right, for the last couple of years or so. That's what so many people feel like today. Like, man, this is just absolutely crazy. When is this going to end? People in Uvalde, people in Buffalo just recently exiled from neighborhoods, exiled from communities for no fault of their own. And I'll tell you something else. Statistics and experience tell me that there are people right here this morning who are exiled from their families. And many times through no fault of your own. I've been working with a lot of executives doing this process that I do in Latin America the last couple of 3 months. And out of the, 15 or so people that I've worked with in the last couple of months, three of them, and these are high-level executive leaders, well-traveled, well-educated, responsible people, three of them that I've worked with are in a position of exile from their own family for no fault of their own. And I want you to know I see you out there this morning. People who have found themselves in a state of exile in one of the richest countries the world has ever seen because you're exiled from your own family. So can we establish that this passage has something to say to most of us here this morning? Okay, you with me? All right, that's exactly where we're going. And one other thing. If you are a follower of Jesus Christ, you are currently in exile. Because Paul says to the Philippians that our citizenship is in heaven. When I was a kid, we used to sing a song, "This world is not my home, I'm just a passing through." So why don't we live like it? Why don't we understand that all of us as followers of Jesus, in one way or another, we are living in exile. And so that means we've got a lot of things to look at this morning. It's 6:05. One other thought, by the way. I love this whole exile thing. You ever hear this cat named Jesus? Okay, all right. Yeah, who voluntarily went into exile on planet Earth to obey his Father on Father's Day. So when you're sitting there going, "Has God forgotten?" Remember Jesus on the cross who said, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Jesus said that because he's very empathetic when you and I are sitting around going, "God, how long does this have to go on? God, have you forgotten? God, why haven't you answered my prayers?" The last words, they come out of the mouth of Jesus. My God, why have you forsaken me?" And then it's finished. Wow. So yeah, this I think Daniel's got some things for us today. 605 BC, he's snatched from his father and family when he's a teenager. This is the first of three Babylonian deportations of the Holy Land that will be finalized in 586 BC when Nebuchadnezzar comes back, wipes out the city of Jerusalem totally, that Jeremiah so graphically describes in his book of Lamentations. And Pastor Tim has been saying as we go through the Bible, when you're in these books like Exodus or Leviticus or Daniel or whatever, look for Jesus. He's there. And the Jesus-like figure in the book of Daniel is the subject of the book itself. It's Daniel. Remarkable figure. Like Joseph, like David, and like others that foreshadow aspects of Jesus to come centuries later. And all of this deportation of Daniel and his three friends is part of a strategy, an ancient strategy, it's still going on today, where a conquering nation would take some of the best and finest of the adolescents in that people group, and they would deport them to the home country and put them through a forced discipleship program to brainwash them into the system of the new society and then send them back to rule over their own people and keep them under control. And by the way, I would suspect that something like that is going on right now in Russia with some brilliant young Ukrainians. It's just the way that life goes on. So that's not a political statement. It's just a statement of strategy. You can see it right here. That's the idea. They bring these kids back to Babylon. They give them new names. They give them new surroundings. They give them a new education and all this type of stuff. They have picked the best and the brightest. So I want you to get your head around who Daniel really is, okay? So Daniel was the type of kid. He's probably about 15 or so when he's deported. That's what most scholars would suspect just from what happens in that period of history. And so he's deported because he is a standout. He is a natural leader. He's probably very athletic. He's probably a great scholar. He's the high school quarterback who dates the beautiful chick, okay? Okay, so what I'm trying to say is this. This revelation hit me in the first service. So Daniel is really Patrick Mahomes. Okay? Can you get your head around that a little bit now? I mean, you take somebody who just, you know, seems to have it all going. And so they said, that's the kid we want right there. And so they drafted him, forcibly drafted him. They did not wait for draft day. They said, you are coming with us. They take him to Babylon. They bring three buddies of his along who are going to be part of the team. And they've got this thing figured out. So Daniel 2 is this long chapter, only time for an overview. Forgive me that I'm going to read quite a bit of it, but I'm going to divide it into three parts. And then I'm going to give you five suggestions on how to excel in exile. So the first part here, I call verses 1 to 13, hard times on a soft bed, because it's all about King Nebuchadnezzar in his palatial bedroom, in his soft bed. He's got probably four or five different mattress toppers on top of it. He's got all types of attendants there. He's got everything that you could want, but he cannot sleep. He's taken the melatonin. He's done the sleeping pills. He's done this. He's done that. He's tried a nightcap. He's called out to Alexa to put on white noise in the background. He's done all of that. And he cannot sleep because he's sitting there and he's wondering what's going to happen to this great empire that I have built. And so what happens is he has a dream that scares him to death, terrifies him, and he can't figure it out. So he calls in all of his spiritual advisors, all of the wise men and the astrologers and all that, says, okay, guys, look, here's the deal. I had this dream, and your job is to interpret the dream for me, but first of all, you're going to have to tell me the dream so that I know you're giving me the straight stuff, because he's probably already a little suspicious of these guys telling him what they think he wants to hear. And so this is the test that he puts them to. They're like, King, you got to be kidding me. I mean, what? You want us to tell you the dream? There's nobody that can do that. And the king is like, well, why don't you guys be the first, okay? Because if you don't do this, I am going to rip you apart and all of your families, tear your houses down, and wipe you off the face of the earth. Because he's a nice guy, right? So we find out that politicians have not changed in all of these many, many centuries. And so he's got this attitude about him, and they're trying to buy time. Well, King, why are you being so unreasonable? He's like, nope. This is it. And verse 12 of chapter 2 says, because of this, the king was angry. He was very furious. He commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be destroyed. So the decree went out, and the wise men were about to be killed, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. Now, can I tell you something? And the reason that Daniel and his companions are singled out, because they're still in this training program. They're supposed to be part of this group of wise men. They're supposed to be part of the ruling elite when they finish their training. And so they're on the list to be killed as well. Can I promise you that these guys are terrified? But they're Jews and they believe in God. I've been in a number of life and death situations myself. And can I tell you that even though you can keep a cool head, it doesn't mean you're not afraid? Okay, talk to people who've been in war situations and stuff like that, police officers, people like that. Listen, if you're not afraid, it's probably because your intelligence level is low. Okay, I'm just going to be honest with you. Okay, but if you've been trained, you're thinking, okay, I'm scared to death, but I'd better keep my wits about me. I'd better think straight, because I'm probably going to need that really quick. And so this is what is going on here. And so Babylon, like Nineveh before them, was famous for cruelty. They seemed to have fun and barbaric activities and ripping people apart, making mountains of skulls and all this type of stuff. But let me point out something. Something very strange happens in verse 4. Then the Chaldeans said to the king, in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will show you an interpretation. Why does it say that? And you're thinking, well, all of a sudden they start talking in Aramaic. No, that's not. No, they've been talking in Aramaic all the way because that's the language that everybody spoke in Babylon. Used to call that Chaldean in the ancient days. And so they're already speaking Chaldean. But why does it say that? The Chaldeans said to the king, in Aramaic. That is not to call your attention that all of a sudden they started talking Aramaic. That's an editorial comment to say, from this point on, Aramaic. Because Daniel starts writing in Aramaic all the way to the end of chapter 7. I find that fascinating. An Orthodox Jew at the time would have a hard time thinking that God could communicate in any language except Hebrew. But all of a sudden, he has put his people in the situation where if somebody doesn't learn a foreign language, they can't figure out what God is doing and what he's going to do because he's written it all in Aramaic. And I'll tell you something else that's kind of weird about this, because most of the Orthodox pious Jews in those days would have thought, well, you know, God has to speak in English. It's kind of like a lot of people here. We think that, you know, God only speaks English, even though only 5% of the world's population speaks English, and we're the only people that have the real Bible and all this type of stuff. Wait. Interestingly enough, the whole book of Daniel takes place in Aramaic. And so the Hebrew part of the book is really a translation from the very beginning. Isn't God cool? God's like, I'm going to mess with your mind right now. And I love that when God does something like that. Why is that? I don't know. Well, I got some ideas, but I'm not going to tell you about that. That's getting down into the, God speaks all languages. That's the point I want to make. Remember, he's the guy that invented them at the Tower of Babel, all that type of stuff. And so Daniel 2 verse 14 begins the second segment of the chapter. The first part was hard times on a soft bed. I call this part heavenly mysteries on a hard bed because Daniel and his buddies are sleeping in the dormitory still. They're still in training. And wow, I can promise you they're probably sleeping on beds that are about as comfortable as metal folding chairs in a church basement. But in that situation, they are going to receive from God an amazing experience. Now, notice how Daniel handles this. Verse 14, Daniel replied with prudence and discretion to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He's afraid. I once, after a Sunday night service in El Salvador, had to disarm a guy who came in, shot a hole in our roof, and was going to kill me. So I had to go and say, sir, my name is, he would say, where's the pastor? I want to kill him. You're looking for him? I'm right here. And it was such a shock to him, he shifted the pistol from one hand to another and shook my hand. You say, wow, what an act of bravery. No, that was an act of survival. And can I tell you that I was scared spitless and thinking, man, this could be, this is the state that Daniel, sometimes we look at these guys in the Bible and we think, well, they're just supernatural and, you know, they're perfect. And no, they're just like us. So, verse 15, he declared to Arioch, the king's captain, why is this so urgent? Then Arioch made the matter known to Daniel. Daniel went in, requested the king to appoint him a time that he might show him the interpretation. Emotions under control, but his emotions are directing him in the right direction. So then Daniel went to the house, made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, and told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes the times and seasons. All of this, he's praising God and giving that. And some of you are saying, God speaks in dreams? Can I confess to you that there was a time in my life when I was younger that I thought that I could tell God what he could and couldn't do? And I've had an amazing experience as I've gotten older. The older I get, it's weird what happens. You get wiser and dumber at the same time. You understand what I'm talking about? Some of you old folks, can you give me an amen there? Some of you old fogies out there, all right, thank you so much. And because it is, all of a sudden you've got this death grip on the things that are really important, and all the other stuff is like, we'll deal with that later. I really don't care. I want to hang on to the things that I really know. So Daniel then, verse 26, goes in and declares the matter to the king. The king declared to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, "Are you able to make known to me the dream that I've seen and its interpretation?" And Daniel answered the king and said, "No wise man, enchanters, magicians, or astrologers can show the king the mystery that the king has asked. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries." Can we just stop right there for a second and say, yay, God? There is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. Wow. Can you imagine in your mind right now? I want you to dredge up in your mind the worst thing that's going on in your life right now. Maybe the biggest question you've got, the biggest challenge you've got, the biggest pain you've got. Could you just dredge that up in your mind? And then would you repeat with me, "But there is a God in heaven." Some of you, I think one of you repeated that with me. You got the thing in your mind. Okay, I'm trying to train you, trying to help you out a little bit, all right? Get the image in your mind. Repeat with me, "But there is a God in heaven." Whew, thank you, God. Yeah, I'm glad to know that some people still alive out there on Father's Day. All right. So Daniel goes through. He just very humbly lays this out before him and all this type of stuff. And that leads us to the next part of the book, or chapter rather, verses 31 to the end of the chapter in chapter 2, the God who never stops being in control. And so what Daniel does, beginning in verse 31, he describes this dream. "You saw, O king, behold, a great image. The image, mighty and exceeding brightness, stood before you. Its appearance was frightening. The head of this image was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its middle and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron, partly of clay. And as you looked, a stone was cut out by no human hand, and it struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron and clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold, all together were broken in pieces and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them could be found. But the stone that struck the image became a great mountain like Mount Aconcagua, only much bigger, and filled the whole earth." And some of you who maybe are not too biblically illiterate, you're thinking, "Now wait a minute, are we in the Chronicles of Narnia or Harry Potter or some sci-fi film? What's going on here? What's this all about?" Well, Daniel then interprets the thing, beginning in verse 36. "This was the dream. Now we will tell the king its interpretation. You, O king, king of kings, to whom God of heaven has given you kingdom and power and the might and the glory, and into whose hand he has given whatever, wherever they dwell, the children of men, the beasts of the field, the birds of the heaven, making you rule over them all. You are the head of gold. Another kingdom inferior to you shall arise after you, and a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth, and shall be a fourth kingdom strong as iron, because iron breaks to pieces and shatters all things, and like iron that crushes, it shall break and crush all these. And as you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it shall be a divided kingdom, but some of the firmness of iron shall be in it, just as you saw iron mixed with the soft clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly iron and partly clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly brittle. As you saw the iron mixed with soft clay, so they will mix one with another in marriage, will not hold together, just as the iron does not mix with clay," and on and on and on and on. And go down to verse 45. "Just as you saw that a stone was cut from a mountain by no human hand, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, a great God has made known to the king what shall be after this. The dream is certain and the interpretation sure." King Nebuchadnezzar's on his bed. He's troubled. He's wondering what's going to happen after him. God says, "I'm going to tell you." And so God gives him this fantastic dream, and all, don't get lost in the weeds of all the prophetic imagery and start, well, iron, well, doesn't that have a gravitational weight? No, it's just stop. Don't miss the picture. What is going on here? The key issue is that this king, Nebuchadnezzar, understand that he is the greatest king that has ever been on the planet for only one reason, because God says, I made you. I made you like this. And there's going to be three kingdoms come after you, and they're going to be great kingdoms. And they're all going to be destroyed, because one day I'm going to cut this stone out with no human hands involved, and all that you see is going to be crushed and made into dust and blown away by the summer wind, because this stone is going to turn into this great mountain, and he is going to fill the earth. Because I think you've got an inkling of who this stone or rock may be. That's the point. And this is what God is speaking to King Nebuchadnezzar. He's not worried about, well, is that going to be this empire? Well, what about this? And what date? Well, he said, no. Get the big picture. You're up on the mountain. Stay up on the mountain with me, okay? That's what is going on here. So five lessons I want to share with you to excel in exile. Lesson number one, submit to God's sovereign control. Don't fight it. Don't question it. Go with the flow. Assyria defeated Israel. Babylon defeats Judah, takes captives. Egypt is finished as a world power. And so the situation for the Hebrew people is totally impossible. Their sins have reduced them to hopelessness. And here, God uses a pagan king to demonstrate that he is the God who does the impossible, and he does it however he wants. And I want you to see that what is going on here in the promise of Israel's restoration is not because revival has broken out in Israel. It has not. It's not because somebody fasted for 100 days. That's not what's going on here. It's simply God is saying, I am in control, and I can use anyone, anytime, and anyhow I jolly well please. So, what was that problem you were worried about when you came in? There is a God in heaven who reveals mystery. And God is going to bring Israel home again by using another pagan king by the name of Cyrus and yet another pagan empire, Persia, to do it. And so all of these promises that God has made to Israel are going to be kept, not because Israel got their hearts right with God and started obeying, but because God said, it's time. And I'm going to do it. Now, that doesn't mean you should disobey God. That's not the point. The point is simply, God is God, and I'm not. That's the point. I love what the psalmist said in Psalm 31:14, but I trust in you, O Lord. I say, you are my God. So don't fight it. See what God is doing. And that is the key. Now, number two, in the darkness of exile, seek God. He's there. You'll never be where God is not. And so when you are in exile, find God. Look at Daniel. This is so important. Daniel learned to focus on what God is doing, not what he, Daniel, should do. When we find ourselves in exile, we find ourselves in those moments where we're saying, oh, God, have you forgotten? Oh, God, what am I supposed to do? Wrong question. The right question is, God, what are you doing? And when you see what God is doing, then you'll know exactly what you should do. You get with him. You go with him. Seek him in the darkness. God works in mysterious ways. He could even use a horrible, despicable human being like Nebuchadnezzar. We see Jesus in Daniel. We saw how God worked his will through Jonah, the horrible prophet, and now we see how God works his will through Daniel, the completely faithful prophet and an amazing human being. The point is simply this: God's always in control, and he does things the way that he wants to do them. It's always been that way. It's always been, well, if I could just do this, if I could just, wrong question, wrong emphasis. It's all about God. Number three, ooh, this is a big one. Stay where God plants you. I'm in exile. Cool. Stay planted. Listen to what Jeremiah said, Jeremiah 29:4. Jeremiah is writing a letter to the exiles that have been deported to Babylon. Okay, this is contemporary with what Daniel is experiencing here. And these words beginning in Jeremiah 29:4 are so important. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, to all the exiles whom I've sent into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Who sent them there? I did, God says. Build houses and live in them. Plant gardens and eat their produce. Take wives and have sons and daughters. Take wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there and do not decrease. But seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will find your welfare. Can I pastor you a little bit, break that down for you just a little bit? Here's what that's saying. I go absolutely livid crazy when I hear believing Christians say things like, well, it's just getting worse and worse and worse, and that means Jesus has got to come back. Oh, I just want to get out of here. Come and get me out of here. No. Listen to what God says through Jeremiah. I sent you there, and I want you to bloom where you're planted. Well, we're in exile. I know. I sent you there. Remember what I said? I sent you there, and I want you to raise families. I want you to connect. I don't want you to worry about getting out of exile. I want you to find out about the city that you live in, and I want you to see the problems that are there, and then you get involved in helping to solve them. Don't stand around on a street corner like an idiot waiting for Jesus to come back and rapture you out. He will rapture you out when he is good and ready. He's already got it planned. He's got his alarm set on his iPhone. He knows when that time is coming, all right? So until that happens, you stay planted, because plants don't grow when they are not planted. And your job is to grow, not to gripe. Your job is not to point your bony finger all around and point out all the problems in the world and society. Your job is to get involved in saying, I'm a believer, how can I help? And you will find your welfare when you are contributing to the welfare of the place where God has chosen to plant you. Amen. Now, yeah, that is so important. Now, listen to me. If God leads you out to another place or situation, then fine, go for it. But, be certain that you are not running from something, but you are being led by God to something. And until God is leading you to something, then you stay where God planted you. Man, I look at Christians, they're like those flocks of birds that we see. It just drives me nuts. I'm not trying to say, hey, look, find a good church, plant yourself there. Okay, I don't like the way they do this or that. Well, maybe they don't like the way that you do things too. That's not the point. The point is, where is God going to plant you? And stay planted. Wow. General guiding principle here, how long do I have to stay in exile? Short answer, until you've accomplished everything that God has for you to accomplish and learn the lessons that he has for you to learn, okay? And then he may or may not lead you out of exile. I don't know. He's God, not me. He's God who can use a dude like Nebuchadnezzar. Are you kidding me? Number four. See your enemies as God's instruments and teachers. Whew, there's a hard one. Don't get even, don't get mad, get smarter and get tougher. Can I just tell you that I cannot remember the names of most of my teachers all the way from grade school to PhD. I can hardly even see many of them. But there are three of them that I remember vividly. And they're the ones that I hated the most. My junior high shop teacher, Mr. Flater, little tiny guy, mean as can be. He had the world's worst paddle that he had personally crafted out of wood, ergonomically designed for his hand, and scientifically designed for maximum impact. I hated this guy. I'd go home and cry to my dad about him. I hated my first German teacher in college. He just absolutely drove me crazy. He gave me the only D that I ever made in my entire academic career. Hated this guy, but he gave me a love and understanding of language. And I hated my philosophy teacher in history of philosophy class because I'd learned by this time I could get by with cliff notes. And if I just sounded philosophical, that, you know, I could get by. And so we were having an oral exam one day in front of the entire class, and he asked me to define Nietzsche's Superman concept and all this stuff. So I'm up there just, you know, bluffing my way through. And not very long into it, he looked at me and said before the entire class, "Mr. Adams, please sit down and shut up. It is obvious that you do not know what you're talking about." Best teachers I ever had. And that's, ladies and gentlemen, what life is all about. All sin causes storms, but not all storms are because of sin. Some storms are too direct, and some storms are too correct. But in every case, it is God who is in control. One final lesson. Yeah, yay God. if anything this morning, we're learning that God is God. Okay, basic. Number five, stay connected in prayer. And notice what Daniel does. Daniel's scared. His three buddies are scared, I promise you that. You know what they did? They shared their burden with each other and they prayed together. You're not going to exit exile by yourself. It's not going to happen. I can handle this. No, you can't. That's why there is a God. You can't handle it by yourself. And God always surrounds us with other human beings that are there to be his instruments to help us. Find out who they are, pray with them. Just like Daniel and his three buddies had this amazing prayer meeting where God saves their lives and the lives of all of the unbelieving wizards and sorcerers and astrologers. It's an amazing story. And can I say one other thing to you? This is a little bit removed from the subject, but yet it's not. This is Father's Day. And as I said earlier when we began this morning, I know that there's people there. There's people here who you've never met your dad. Some of you don't even know who your dad is. You don't know whether he's alive or dead because you've never met him and you don't know who he is. Some of you, your dad walked out on you when you were still a kid, when you needed him the most. Your dad went into self-imposed exile for whatever reason or another and left you without a father. And that's tough, right? When you read the Bible with that bird's eye Aconcagua view, one thing that is impressed upon you repeatedly throughout the entire scriptures is that God has a special place in his heart for widows and the fatherless. And I think we would be remiss on this Father's Day if we did not remember that we have a Father who is like no other. He is our God. But if you're a young man here today and you're kind of feeling the burden because you're feeling all the pulls here and the pulls there, and maybe you don't even know who your dad is, maybe your dad's in prison, maybe your dad walked out of the family, I don't know, and I hate that. I hate that you don't have the perfect family, but I don't know of anybody in this room that has the perfect family, do you? So what you do is you do the best you can with what you have. And if you don't have a human dad, you've got a heavenly dad who is absolutely amazing. And I'd like to ask you as we prepare to dismiss this morning, if you just stand, let me pray for you. And I hope that something that's been said this morning would be of use to you in your journey, in your walk of faith. But most of all, that you would simply remember this morning that there is a God in heaven. And he is my God and your God. So Father, would you pour out your blessings upon this group of people today that I love, upon this amazing Graceway family. Lord, I pray for the fatherless here today. I pray to you, our Father, who is in heaven, whose name is above all names. Lord, would you today, on this Father's Day, reach out to the fatherless, the discouraged, and would you just pour out your love and grace and mercy upon them in such a way that they are fulfilled and satisfied by your grace. Lord, thank you for who you are. And thank you for including us in your family. We pray for all of us as we leave here today to go rejoicing in hope and knowing that you are in control. In Jesus' name, amen.